The topic which I just saw on the poster as I walked in here is stresses of modern life, can meditation help? And the topic I had hoped to talk on, which obviously didn't reach the publishers of that printers, was the foundations of a good life, but I'm sure I can sort of string them together somehow. I don't think I'm very qualified to talk about the stresses of modern life, because I've chosen a very medieval way of living, actually. I have had a lot of stress in leadership, in responsibility, and so on, but my life has a lot of space in it for meditation. So bear with me in my kind of limitations on how I can talk, address that kind of topic. What I was kind of pondering, the ideas of what a good life is very important in Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist way of doing things. I've just been reading a very well-written but very disturbing book about a Latvian emigre from Riga who ran, whose parents fled in 1944 during the war, and it's a similar history to my own parents' history. He's a Canadian historian from the University of Toronto, and he describes the horrors of the Second World War and the First World War, and so I've been talking with my mother about the war, it's very, very disturbing how off human beings can get, how all of Europe could be annihilating each other. 27 million Russians killed, and these appalling numbers that I was reading. I found it very, very disturbing, because my roots are from those times, and just you wonder how humanity can be so off, so cruel, so vicious. So obviously, a part of a good life is just decency. Moral decency and moral sensitivity and ecological sensitivity and so on. And these are accepted things. And these things need to be upheld very strongly. Very, very important not to compromise on those things because of some passion or some economic end or whatever. Very, very important to do that, because that's a standard that protects the society from becoming evil. And when I read or I see, I kind of blaming one side for killing these people and another side killing those people or atrocities and so on. Certainly we blame that, but the reason that happens is because evil is stimulated in the human mind, and once evil and those kinds of things get going, you don't know where it's going to go to. And it's dangerous, because these energies exist in humanity. So this is very fundamental, isn't it? And I'm sure we all agree with that. There's no problem with that. So there's that, just the good society. And I think I've been living outside of Canada since 1969, and I find any time I read a report about Canada, and I always joke about this, is that it's the best country in the world. Of course, when I come, Canadians don't quite think so. They might have different views. But as far as countries can go, we have a very good social system and so on. And Canadians seem to be quite dedicated to that kind of goodness, social goodness, which is wonderful. Sometimes a good life is seen, you know, being able to ski in Vermont and kids go to Harvard and you can get a new Apple computer with whatever you want in it. That's the good life. Acquisition, getting something, is that kind of idea. And I'm sure you have other definitions of it. What I would like to address maybe is the idea of goodness as skillfulness, because this is the way the Buddha suggested we consider the word goodness. In the Pali language, it's called kusala. Kusala kamma or kusala dhamma. The idea that there are activities, there's thinking, there's action, which is skillful. there is way, communication which is skillful, there's ways of thinking which are skillful, and there is unskillfulness, isn't there? There are ways of talking which are unskillful, there are ways of eating which are unskillful, there are ways of reading things which are unskillful. So skillfulness and unskillfulness are very, very important parts of the Buddhist path. Meditation is part of the skillful aspect of that. The basis of Buddhist skillfulness is satisampajanya. Satisampajanya is mindfulness or awareness and discernment, or awareness and clear comprehension. The Buddha's practice, his way, was based upon knowing the way things are. Because I can only understand skillfulness and unskillfulness if I really see cause and effect. If I see that these kinds of actions, these kinds of thoughts, these kinds of relationships or whatever lead to a wholesome result, lead to a wholesome result, a skillful result for me and my society. And these other kinds lead to the opposite. And it's only when I can see that, for me at least, when I really see how that works with mindfulness, with clear comprehension, that I go beyond just being idealistic. Idealism is fine, but sometimes idealism can be a kind of bludgeon we direct at ourselves. I have an ideal of being a sensitive person, and then when I'm insensitive, I hate myself. Which isn't mindfulness and clear comprehension, or mindfulness and discernment, it's actually self-judgment. And there's a huge difference between self-aversion and self-knowing. And that I find, at least in Western cultures, is a kind of confusion that can come up. Because people who enter onto a spiritual path or enter into a sense of inner responsibility, people who do that are usually very good people. They have high ideals. They really don't want to blow it and dump their stuff on people and so on and so forth. And that kind of idealism then, rather than being an aspiration, becomes the way we judge ourselves. So there's a kind of judge in the head who says, guilty. You weren't nice, guilty. You overslept, guilty. You ate that cake, guilty. You didn't meditate, guilty. You know? Which isn't mindfulness and clear comprehension, it's just a bad habit. And it's unskillful, isn't it? It's unskillful. And things like that, excuse me a bit, things like that can be so close to home we think it's ultimate truth. Can't it? You know, I can say to myself, oh, I'm no good and so on. You can say to me, actually, you're all right. And I'll say, yeah, you don't really know. You don't really know me. And these very deep-seated aspects of delusion and suffering and inner stress that we have need to be, we need to awaken to those. So the basis of a Buddhist practice of skillfulness is mindfulness and discernment, mindfulness and clear comprehension. And this is very ordinary, but at times extraordinarily difficult. It's just the awakening to what's going on now. It's like really awakening. How do I feel? Like in this meditation, what does my body feel like now? What is the mood of the mind? How am I relating to the environment, to the people around me? Awakening. It's not a judgment. It's not saying you should feel anything. It's awakening. And you can see, if the mind is awakened, if it's really present and not demanding that the present moment be a particular way or the heart be a particular way, in that awakeness there's edification. There's insight. There's realization. One sees clearly. And the longer one can sustain awareness in an open-hearted way, in a kind of welcoming way, in a receptive way, the more continuous and long-ranging that awareness is, the clearer the insight will be. The clearer I will understand that with this kind of activity, I can bear myself. And this microphone is falling off. And it's a setup. Where's Andre? I'll put it there. Okay. Okay. Now, when I can see that in my own mind, when I can see that, say, like if I feel restless, right? I'm feeling restless and I'm feeling tense and all that. And then I really watch that, and then I just do things out of that restlessness. I get into a kind of workaholic mode. And I watch that and I see, well, actually that doesn't lead to an end of restlessness. It leads to more restlessness. That gives me the incentive to change. I still have to work on the habit, right? But it gives me an incentive because I don't want to suffer. And the Buddha's teaching is based upon that we don't want to suffer. We want to be free from suffering. We want to be free from stress, whatever way you want to put that. So that's the first step, and often it's the last step. First and last step is awareness, awakening. And you can do that anytime. But what is difficult about awareness is that we forget. You know, we get very much lost in our habits, in our duties, and all the things that overwhelm us. In societies which tend to be, urban societies tend to be very busy, don't they? There's always so much information people are processing, and there's always seems to be so much to do. And so meditation, where meditation fits into, say, mindfulness and awareness, it's like taking a deliberate step back from engagement. It's like fasting from sense experience. You know, not just food, but computer screens and duties and responsibilities. Fasting or stepping back from that. And everyone asks me, that's all right for you as a monk. You know, I just did a 3-month retreat, so I'm feeling a little guilty in front of you here. But it is true that if you can step back and you can establish mindfulness on the breath, even you might feel tense and restless, then what you've established is a skillful state of mind, a wholesome state of mind, and you've given that some power. You've given it some momentum. So that when one enters into the complexities of life, the mind has some skillfulness in it. The mind has some body to it. Awareness has some body to it. And awareness doesn't, you know, it has less chance of being overwhelmed by unskillfulness. And if you think about that, like when people go on retreat or when they have a vacation, when they take a break, right? And they feel rested, and the mind's at ease. Then when we enter into complexity, in those initial hours or days or whatever, we quite often see how tensions arise, don't we? You see how you're kind of getting wrapped up with something. And then maybe we panic. We think, oh God, I've lost it. Or I want to be back on a retreat and so on. But in that phase, or in that change from silence, from stillness, from meditation, from fasting, into engagement, into doing, into responsibility, that kind of point of transfer or that movement is very insightful, because we see that's where I'm getting attached. That's where I'm losing the mindfulness. That's where the habits are overtaking me. If one sees meditation as a drug trip. You know, you do your meditation and you just feel high. Nice, okay. But the danger there is then one gets attached to refinement. And maybe this isn't a problem with lay people, it's certainly a problem with the monastics. Where we'll do, you know, we do a lot of meditation, we train a lot in that. And there'll be, you know, you get, like, especially the first years of meditation, get some lovely experiences, really exalted experiences. And then one thinks, that's it, now I've got it. And of course, go to the kitchen, go to the office, go to the committee meeting, and then you come out of it, I've lost it. It's gone. And you feel very kind of deflated. But that's not, the point of meditation isn't to get high. One does have very, very beautiful experiences, but that's not the point of it. For me at least, and from what I see how Buddhism operates, the point of it is to create that skillfulness of mind so that we can be in complexity, we can be where our buttons are pushed, and we can get insight. Now if we can get insight into those areas, then those areas which tend to upset us or bring up anxieties or these different modes of suffering that we might have, if we can have insight, then those very areas become the ways we develop more skillfulness. We actually establish a foundation of freedom within complexity. On the other hand, if complexity is overwhelming, you can't do it. And that's when people get nervous breakdowns. So it's not a cure-all for everything, right? So it's fine to say, like I tend to have a mind which likes any challenge, I should take it on until I get burnt out. And then I say, whoops. So it's not just an absolute thing that you have to take everything on and you're going to learn from it, because you might not learn from it. You might just get blown away by it. Fair enough. Huh? But if there can be mindfulness around, say, a difficult person, and one can feel the sense of judgment coming up, or feel the sense of anxiety coming up with that person, or aversion, or whatever, and one can witness to that with awareness and not feed it with a storyline, then what happens is the unskillful parts of the mind begin to cease and begin to fade. So there's skillful and unskillful. And unskillful arises, it's the whole scenario of your buttons getting pressed. And if one develops the sense of this is like a pilgrimage, you know, that these difficulties that we have, it's like part of the pilgrimage. And part of the pilgrimage is that you have to, you have to cross the rapids. You have to climb up to 8,000 feet. You have to go through a snowstorm. You have to get massive blisters and all of that. And it's life, isn't it? None of us get away with anything, do we? I mean, we're all challenged. And if the attitude is one of developing enough mindfulness so that those very tendencies which are unskillful, the tendencies to greed, hatred, and delusion, the tendencies to whatever modes of suffering we have, if we see that as an opportunity for those tendencies to end, then right there the pilgrimage is successful, isn't it? But we need mindfulness. We need skillfulness. So the emphasis on Buddhism is very often understanding the particular mode of attachment that's happening right now. And this is the skillfulness of wisdom. Wisdom is released or is allowed to function. It's a function of the human mind when we're aware. When we're judging, when we're running away, when we're distracting, those kinds of things, that wisdom doesn't have a chance to function because we're too busy. If I'm busy saying how that there's something wrong with me, and I haven't even looked, I haven't paid attention to that, then how can wisdom see? Because wisdom is the intuitive faculty. When we're open, when we're receptive to life, we notice things like nature. If you just observe nature, say I was observing owls. I was living in the forest in Chithurst, and we have a large monastery, and I had these masses of owls hooting all night, lovely owls. And just by listening to them, I didn't know owls. I know a little bit about owls now, but by just listening and observing, I figured something out about owls, right? And that, what is that? That's not the same as it's something in me that can understand, isn't there? There's wisdom in me. That's there, that's available. And that wisdom can become manifest when we stop trying to figure it out, I think. Stop criticizing as being wrong. See, this is the way it is now. How does it feel? And the Buddha stresses, why do you suffer? What is suffering? How does suffering manifest inwardly? How does it work? And so there has to be this kind of curiosity about suffering, and that's hard. Because we don't want to suffer. You have to be curious about loneliness. You have to be curious about anxiety. You have to be curious about being fed up. Huh? And to bring that kind of attitude to all the things that we do, meditation is very helpful. And when you can get that kind of spaciousness and observe in that way. So wisdom, we would say, is seeing the way things are. And eventually that gets translated into thought. And then you have books and teachings and so on. So a teaching, So a character like me talking, or books, or whatever you're using, a teaching is like a mirror. A mirror for all of us to say, well, how does my activity and thoughts and so on, how do I measure up to that? Not as a judgment, but just to see, how does it work for me? So you get a teaching in Buddhism, a simple teaching that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. Change. Right? Change. Things change, which is pretty obvious. And that anything that begins ends, right? And that seems pretty simple. Yeah, doesn't take PhD for that. Okay, I got that. What's the next? But to actually apply that teaching, that which begins ends. So you're meditating. Meditators, okay. You begin meditation, and you think you've got it. You get inspired. Most people, this happens in meditation. You start meditation, and your mind's very fresh, very clean. You've never meditated before. You've got no preconceptions, no history, no memories. And you have a nice meditation. And then there's a sense of confidence and or inspiration in the mind. Then, of course, you think, next time I meditate, I'm going to have the same confidence, the same inspiration, the same peace. That's the expectation, history. You sit down, of course, you can't get together. You're restless, leg hurts, you're fed up, don't want to do it. And then you walk out of the meditation thinking, I've lost it. Now, if you're contemplating that which has a nature to arise as a nature to cease, and one really does contemplate that as a mirror for one's life, then when the mind becomes inspired, or when the mind becomes confident, there's something in one which says, yeah, but that which has a nature to arise as a nature to cease. Confidence, you can't rely on it. Trouble is, confidence is nice. Or inspiration. Inspiration is also, you can't rely on it, but it's nice. Now, when we are really looking at the way things are, then when confidence comes, or doubt comes, there is something behind that, the knowing, which is peaceful, which is neither confident nor doubtful. It knows. This is confidence. It arises and ceases. It endures for a while. When the conditions change, it changes. And that kind of insight then is a deepening of what we call discernment. One's understanding of nature becomes more and more deep. So one's awareness becomes more and more profound. It's not just a sort of haphazard thing. One really understands. One really understands the way things are. And as one understands the way things are, other factors begin to click into place, like patience, forbearance. It's tremendously important, whether you're meditating, whether you're just living a normal life. So much of life is negative. You know, from the flu to whatever. Much of life. And that's the way it's designed, isn't it? You can't get away from that. The body has pain. We feel boredom. We feel disappointment. We get betrayed. The body dies. People disappoint, etc., etc. And now all of those things have a kind of negative impact. Which is difficult. So the feeling that I have of confidence or inspiration or all of that is different than the feeling of disappointment and doubt. They're different. It's a different feeling. One feels pleasant, one feels unpleasant. But the spiritual life, the religious life, is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. It's a transcendence of both of those polarities into a deeper silence. Into a deeper silence, which is accessed through awareness and wisdom. Now, as long as we pursue the pleasant, and so on, so as long as we think that's it, we'll always be fooled. And it'll always take us to the opposite. I was watching this on the retreat, where because I was doing such a long retreat, I get some very sublime mind states. And I mean, it was such a... And I've been at it for a while now. And this insidious nature just to really think, now I've got it. Finally, you know. And I've been through this so many times, but now I finally have it. And, I mean, I just set myself up. Next day, you know, God, it's restless. And this is after 25 years of meditation. And it's maybe I'm just a bit thick, but these things that because we want something to hold on to, don't we? Because we like security, we like the known, we don't like insecurity, we don't like loneliness, they're not kind of pleasant states of mind. And yet, if we don't learn to see that they are part of the same coin, that confidence, inspiration, and doubt are part of the same coin, we'll always just be flipping around with it, won't we? And once we begin to see that, then we can really appreciate confidence. We can appreciate joy, we can appreciate beauty, we can appreciate the beauty in others, and actually really be with it, and not be afraid of its loss, because we know it'll go. And then, but the opposite too, which is maybe more difficult, I don't know, but is to be with all those negative states of mind. To really, I got quite burnt out about a year and a half ago, and I got very, very depressed. And, you think, God, what's this Buddhism worth anyways, if this is what happens? But then I just contemplating, well, this is just the result. This is the result. This is nature. Depression is natural. And this mind has to experience depression now because it got overworked, got overtired, got burnt out. Now I can, now I'm trying to develop skillfulness around things like that, so I'll be in a cave the rest of my life, maybe. but to see that that's okay too. That these feelings are very, very natural. And the more we can see that it's all natural, depression is natural, the anger is natural, and we can forbear. And this is where forbearance is very important. And have the confidence that if we do the skillful things now, if we act skillfully, if we speak skillfully, if we think skillfully, then we'll get a skillful result. That's the kind of faith one needs to have in this practice, to bear witness to the difficult bits. And we all get them, all those difficult bits of the heart and mind, to forbear. And then what you get is a kind of openness of the heart to the flow of life. And it's a kind of peacefulness and equanimity, but it's very heartfelt. Because one is really engaging with life in a heartfelt way. One says, well, this is life. Life feels this way. It does feel down. And from that I find there's this arising of compassion. Not compassion as just an ideal, but as a real deep feeling of what it means to be human. To be human means we feel these very, very real things. And this ability to forbear, to bear witness to, when one gets through the negativities, when one goes through the dark night of the soul, or when one goes through the morbidio and furiori, the different ways we talk about that, then there's a tremendous confidence in the heart that's all right too. And then the next time it comes up, those habits, because they are habitual, you say, oh, I know you. I danced with you last year, didn't I? And you almost fooled me. But there is a confidence that builds. And that confidence, that kind of confidence and awareness and discernment becomes less and less shakable. The conditions still are there that can come up. Let's say something like resentment. Say that's a resentment can be an awful broken record, can it? We have what we call in retreats. We call it washing machine mind. Where you get one of these front loading washing machines, and you've got window there, and you've got jeans, towel, underwear. And it just goes jeans, towel, underwear, jeans, towel. We call this washing machine mind in the monastery. And then, so you're sitting on a retreat, you got jeans, towel, and things like resentment. If you ever go on a retreat, you just, oh, it's going to be so nice and peaceful. This resentment keeps coming up again and again and again, or something like that keeps niggling the mind. And so things like that, like say if you take resentment, if you get really betrayed by someone, then you have the memory, then you have the resentment, then you have the memory, then you have the resentment. It goes like that, doesn't it? And if you think about that memory, you can really proliferate on it. You can keep building and building and building it. So it seems hopeless and endless. But if one bears witness to the feeling, well, resentment feels this way. That's a huge step in awareness. Whereas if I just bind to the storyline and I either blame the person who betrayed me or I blame myself for still feeling this resentment after 25 years or whatever, then that's not awareness. That's what we call ego view. I am someone who got hurt, blah, 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 and then they did that to me, and then I did this, and we did that, and then it goes on and on and on. Or I'm a terrible person, I should love everyone, I'm a Buddhist, you're a rotten creep, you're a dumbo, you know. But that's not awareness, is it? Whereas awareness is, resentment feels this way. And that's where, like, body meditations are so helpful. If you can get out of this space and come down into your guts and into your heart and into your chest, or into the feelings in the body and bear witness to resentment, then the power of resentment, say, as an example of a habit, the power of resentment begins to cease. But still, if the memory comes, the resentment might still come. But that's all right, because that's karma. That's what we mean by karma. The mind is conditioned to react in that way. But as we witness to that more and more, we don't feel threatened by it, and also it's more and more quiet. So something which was like a huge volcano in your mind is just a hiccup. It hasn't got that power. But quite often, if some of these things, we just have to keep having faith in our own goodness, faith in our own intentions, and faith in just awareness. Let awareness sort this out. It's not my problem, it's just the mind. The mind does this, the mind feels resentment. And then it goes into the storyline, blah, 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 and say, no, well, what does it feel like? What is the forbearance, wisdom, insight, that which has a nature to arise has a nature to cease. This is the kind of Buddhist mantra, that something begins, it endures, it goes away. It begins, it endures, it goes away. Now, if I can apply that to the highs and lows of my life, then I don't get drawn into the highs and lows. I can just know them in a peaceful way. On the kind of heart level, skillfulness, we have, as human beings, we have emotions, we have thoughts, and we've all figured out that thoughts are not, emotions are not rational, right? We've all figured that one out? Okay. That took me a long time. So if you try to deal with the emotions at a kind of rational way, one usually gets caught into idealism. So the ideal is compassion, caring, sensitivity, so on and so forth, and non-anger, non-aversion, and such like. And then one approaches the heart with the head, and it's a disaster. Because the heart is not the head, and the head is not the heart. It's different. It's a different realm. And that's very, very important. So ideals are good, aspirations are good, but what does it mean to be an emotional being? What do emotions actually feel like? This is nature. You might not like it, that's tough. It's just, we are emotional beings, we have emotions, and they're very, very important, obviously, very important to understand that. Not to dismiss it or whatever, but to actually understand it. So the Buddhist practice around the emotional realm is very much an opening, a kind of receptive awareness of the whole range that we might experience, from the sublime and the altruistic to the most evil kind of things that you might experience. There's an openness in awareness. Awareness isn't just a kind of controlling of things. Awareness isn't just a cerebral noticing of things, at least not for me. Awareness for me is an opening, a receptivity, a consideration of the fullness of this experience. Some things are very difficult to experience that way. Some things are easier to experience that way. And so the fundamental skillful trait or attitude or mindset that we're trying to develop in Buddhism is the feeling of benevolence, is the feeling of amity, is the feeling of non-aversion to the way things are. And that can be at a kind of personal level. May all beings be well. May all beings be free from suffering. May I be well. May I be free from suffering. Or it can just be benevolence to this particular mood, benevolence to this particular body state, benevolence to this particular social situation, benevolence, those things. And that's what we try to encourage. And quite often the way we have to encourage that is by being benevolent to aversion. You have to begin somewhere. So if one is full of aversion, fine. But at least in that moment, say, aversion feels this way. Because if one begins with idealism, there's no end to the frustration of that, if one attaches to idealism. So have the ideal of compassion, the reality is cruelty. What we do is, in Buddhism we say, don't act on cruelty. Try not to speak on cruelty. But recognize cruelty as a mode of suffering that has to be enveloped with compassionate awareness. Now if I do that, let's say I feel cruel impulses and I'm able not to hurt people with speech or with the body. That's a very important step, morality. And then the cruelty comes into my mind. Can you see, like, cruelty is an unskillful state of mind. Cruelty is a mind that if I pursue that, obviously I'm going to suffer and those around me are going to suffer. But if I look at cruelty and say, Virdhama, you're really suffering, aren't you? That very attitude is what? It's compassion. And that's beginning to change the mind. Beginning to transform the mind, not by judging cruelty as being wrong or getting rid of it, by saying, I'm suffering. May I be free from suffering. The mindset begins to change. Huh? And then as one does that, of course, the more one does that, or creates, or stimulates, or encourages a sense of benevolence, that begins to have more power. There's more power in the mind. And then as the cruel impulses come, the impulses to hurt others with speech or whatever, they have a stronger mirror which they are bounced off of. One sees. Like if you've done any meditation practices on benevolence, which we do a lot of in Buddhism, you sit down and for a half hour you just think good thoughts. May I be well, may you be well. Do it for half an hour. Now, if one isn't just trying to get high on that, one actually just tries to put that intention into the mind, then what happens is you tend to notice cruelty more, don't you? If I've just said, may all beings be well, may all beings be free from suffering, then I walk out of here, and then I see someone who is loud and say, what an idiot. I'm going to notice that. I'm going to notice that put down. Why? Because I've just said, may all beings be free from suffering. And this is how we try to develop types of meditation. We try to develop types of meditation to create the contrast, the balance, the peacefulness, so that we can notice the ingrained habits. So all those habits like cynicism, self-criticism, self-hatred, anger, aversion, all those kinds of mind states that we have, if we pursue them, that we won't be happy. I suffered a lot from cynicism, a kind of clever ability to put down people. And I've not liked it in myself, but it's not brought me happiness, but I've just had to learn how to know it, say, that's suffering, may I be free from suffering until it's ceased. Now I tried to work with cynicism by saying, you're awful. But what do I do if I say that? What if I do, I feel a cynical thought, say something cynical and so on, and then I also, on top of that, I say, you're awful, Virdhama. What am I doing? I'm feeding cynicism with aversion. It loves it. It's great. Give me more. So it goes in, it goes out, it goes in, but it doesn't really change. The mind never changes because it's the same habit. It seems nice from the idealistic maybe point, but it doesn't really transform one. But transformation is like acceptance. This is the way it is now. And then right thought, right attitude, cultivating that from acceptance, not from trying to dismiss it. And this sense of benevolence is terribly important as a foundation for the spiritual life, as a foundation for enlightenment. Without that, without benevolence, it's not possible, because one continually feels alienated, disgruntled with life. There's benevolence, there's compassion, there's also joy. And joy is something that often is seen to be something you get by having sense experiences which are happy. So there's the joy of a beautiful sunrise or bungee jumping or whatever gives you joy. That's we would call sense happiness. But there's a gladness in the heart which we feel as human beings. There's a gladness at at the wonder of nature, isn't there? There's a gladness at the beauty of someone else's skillful works. There's a gladness at, when I hear my teacher describe something that I've been trying, I'm fumbling to describe, but he does it in a way which is really, you know, right on or something. Wow, that's nice. There's a kind of gladness there, isn't there? The opposite is jealousy. The opposite is like feeling threatened by the beauty of others and so on. Now that sense of gladness can be encouraged in the human heart. So in terms of skillful and unskillful you have things like the alienation of competition, of jealousy, of feeling intimidated by someone's prowess at something or someone's skill. Those kinds of feelings. And you can see, if I pursue that, that's not going to make me happy. It's not going to make others happy either. If I pursue jealousy or those things, that's not going to make... So that's unskillful. But it's there. Not to deny it. It's still there. But those times when I can look at a child and just find happiness in its ability to say a word, or I can look at the colors of the trees, or I can look at the moss in the ground, and there's this kind of joy in the mind. That we have too, don't we? Now, in terms of skillfulness and unskillfulness, I think it's very important to encourage gladness. Now, that you can do skillfully. You can do it environmentally. That's a skillful way to do it. But you can also think. So one can sit down and think about one's good qualities. Now, that's very hard to do, often for people, if one has a strong critical mind. But to actually, you know, like to think, well, I am a moral person. And I have good intentions, etc. To think that of other people. Well, I had an interesting experience during this retreat. I found out towards the end of the retreat that my mother had a fall and bumped her head. I'd phone her every fortnight. And my mind just, you know, she's 83, I'm in, starts to worry. And I'll get depressed. So I find with myself, saying, you know, trying to develop skillful states of mind, I can have a lot of empathy and feel deep compassion, but that is quite often misdirected into things like worry and anxiety and depression. So something which is really wholesome, skillful, if I'm not aware, takes me into something unskillful. Many people probably have that kind of predicament. So as I was meditating, and I had a lot of space around this, I talked to her on the phone, and it was about half an hour to the meal, so I was doing walking meditation, just walking back and forth, and just seeing, because it really hit me quite strongly, just seeing, well, what does that feel like? What does that feel like? And then I go into the mind. I have to do something. Maybe I should phone her up again. But what does that feel like? Now, I know my brother's here, and she said she's all right and so on. So that was covered. But just to watch the habit of feeling this deep pain for her, and then it going off into worry. So then I started to actually go to that feeling of compassion. I just started to bring in a lot of beings into that, but I wouldn't let it go into worry. And it was a very beautiful feeling, actually. Very, very beautiful. But then, there's that, and that's good. And then for some reason, I just started to think about my mother's good qualities. She's a really good woman. And I started to make conscious her goodness. And that brought me a lot of happiness. But it didn't solve her headache. But it brought a balance to my own heart and mind, didn't it? And that we can do that. If we're aware... if we're aware of how our hearts and minds work, we can direct the mind. We can direct the mind into skillful avenues, skillful ways. And if we do that, then again, the power of goodness, not just the smarmy sentimentality, not that. The power of goodness, because goodness does have power, this power of skillfulness makes us more and more aware of unskillfulness. So it's compounded. It kind of assists itself. And then the most difficult around, I'm talking about the heart now, the way that Buddhists and Buddhism deals with the heart, is equanimity. And now equanimity, in the Buddhist sense, it's usually I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, abide supported by my karma, whatever I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So it's a very responsible kind of teaching. Be careful. But for me, that often remains kind of intellectual. And it's like up here. And the teachings around equanimity, or upekā in Nepali, the way they're put is unbounded, immeasurable. So there's this sense of complete open-heartedness. And that's, I think, in religion where you get the ideas of surrender. You know, whether it's surrender to, in a theistic sense, or it's surrender to karma, or whatever one has to, way to do, to actually really accept this moment the way it is fully, that it is nature in its changing way. That one I find very difficult, because I go, the empathy takes over, I can get kind of tired and so on. But contemplate that, like with anxieties and things like that. You're worried about things. And plan your day and all that, you know, trust in God and tie your camel, right? Trust in Allah and tie your camel. And tie your camel. So once you've tied the camel, you still have to trust in Allah. Or get the idea? So trusting in God is like really just trusting. This is, you know, that I have the equipment to deal with this. That my intentions are pure, that I do live a good life, and that I'll be able to deal with it. So the anxiety, you don't get rid of it, but you surrender. You open up the heart. And then that anxiety has a chance to relax. And that's where equanimity is heartfelt rather than just headfelt. So these ways, benevolence, gladness, equanimity, are meditations that we try to develop in Buddhism to really open up the heart. So I sort of covered a lot of things there, but if I could just return to that microphone which fell on the floor. If I could just return to that simple idea that this is the way it is now. But how is it? How is it for you? How do you feel? You feel hot, you feel bored, fine. But what is boredom like? Or what is heat like? And not to create stress around that and tension. To kind of continue to take responsibility. This is the way it is now. And then as the mind begins to react, well, I don't want it this way. Yeah, but it is this way. That's something I'm creating around it, aren't I? Something I'm adding to it. And that is a continual reflection which takes us to peace. A letting go of stress with this kind of open-hearted attitude. All right? I'll leave that. Yes, Sunia.
Hi, how are you?
Good, you?
Good.
Nice to see you.
I got in a raging debate the other day with someone on the issue of discerning difference between good and bad, or good and evil, I guess. And I argued very passionately and very successfully that there's something even human, like you, a soul, that is capable of discerning difference between good and bad, or good and evil. But what is an ethical sense for want of a better word? A few moments ago, you said something which also completely defeats my theory. So I thought I'd get it straight with you.
What did I say?
You talked about the transcendence of the polarity being such things as the discomfort of the moment, boredom, or extreme euphoria, and you made reference to a deeper silence, which is, I think, what I've come to understand is also awareness, and that through meditation you deepen your inner deeper silence. But that silence seems to me to be a peculiar creation. And it seems to me that it is in that silence that would abide the ability to discern the difference between good and evil, or to be the ethical sentinel. And that's kind of where I get screwed up, is do I understand that discernment as one of the polarities?
No, no. It's what I meant by intuitive wisdom. That when the heart is still, there's an intelligence functioning, because this is a being that doesn't want to suffer, right? And there's an integrity that functions from that stillness. Well, the polarities, I mean, just sense experience, sight, sounds, thoughts, feelings, emotions. These are polar. So you can't have hot without cold. But discernment is something deeper. It's a skillful quality of mind, which is the foundation for enlightenment. So I think I'm all right. But you know, like with debates with people, sometimes if you make it an abstract, then you know it's kind of pros and cons. But if you just know, what do you know for yourself? I know when I do certain things, I get a rotten result, and it's rotten for me. When I do other things, I get a wholesome result. That I know for sure. If it doesn't work for someone else, well, I can't say whether everyone has that kind of. Possibly, I can only say for myself. It works for me, so I can try to share that. And that kind, you know, that's real. Whereas when one starts to get into absolutes, philosophical absolutes, you usually get arguments. You know, but if you keep it really simple, there is goodness. There are skillful things that, you know, that have good results for me and those around me. It's very simple. Yeah? Any other?
How do you both live in the moment and be mindful and at the same time make plans or do goal setting or, you know, even have ambitions, say?
But try to see the difference between planning and anxiety. So definitely don't be some, you know, kind of flaky airhead that's just floating around and it's all perfect and you're hit by the bus. You know, that would be irresponsible. So that what you have is you use your social responsibilities as your framework for understanding yourself. So your social responsibilities require you to be skillful with the management of money or skillful with the management of time, right? And that determines what you do in a given year or whatever. That moves you around in the world. That moves you into different social situations. And within all that movement, then you watch things like anxiety, aversion. So inner awareness is always like a kind of dimension that becomes stronger and stronger. And then you'll see how when you have a plan, you attach to the success of the plan, the future's unknown, you don't know if it's going to win, you have anxiety because you want it to work, and all that becomes a teaching around anxiety. Now, if one just believes in the storyline, then one worries. You know, so I'm planning, oh, it's not going to happen, but if one is saying, okay, I've made the plan, and what's going on now? So you have to take a break from planning. What's going on now? And you see the mind's, oh, this is what worry feels like. And that's very important to say, well, it doesn't really matter what I'm worried about on a dharmic sense. It matters that I begin to understand worry. And yet not to deny one's social responsibilities, one's, you know, all of that. So you're trying to do, like Buddhism is always like, there's always like two veins of practice. There's the social vein, with the emphasis on moral and social responsibility, and there's the inner vein of watching. So the social vein is the storyline. The storyline, who you are in this world, and your family history and such like, which is in time, past, future. Whereas the Dharma is timeless. So it's here now, what am I attached to, how do I let go? And it's like that poem, Eliot's poem, the intersection of the timeless with time. That's the occupation of a saint, to realize the intersection of the timeless with time. And you're constantly trying to do that. And then you see how like, say, sense of self is very much based in time. If you look at how, say, anxiety, you start to think about a possible failure, it'll always be me failing, won't it? And so you see how the sense of self arises with unskillful states of mind. But then you say, oh, this is anxiety, it feels this way. Sense of self falls away. It's just the sense of being, that's still there, but the sense of ego in that kind of way. This is just anxiety. And time falls away. It really becomes timeless. There is no past and future, it's just this now. And then the anxiety comes up again. Oh, what am I going to do? And then there's a sense of past, oh, that happened, and then the future, and me, and all of that. And then, yeah, but anxiety feels this way, and time ceases. And the religious life is this entering into the timeless, but within time. It's a kind of paradox, an intersection. Yeah? Any other questions?
I've been trying to practice awareness for a long time, but there are times when I wish I could just go back into doing things by habit.
Me too.
There's so much intensity to being always aware or trying to always be aware.
Well, I think that's where the idea is for me. I mean, I know what you mean. I often talk in the monastery, I just want to go to a pub and forget this. Slice it. But for me, I guess where my practice is getting to is very much almost like prayer. And Buddhists don't have prayer, but this sense of really. Really opening up, rather than awareness being this kind of, like this slow walking meditation that is done. You know, so you walk, right? And okay, that gives you a lot of concentration. But like Ajahn Chah used to joke, "What do you do if you have diarrhea?" I've really tried to look at my own practice. It's like, what's the difference between controlled kind of awareness and just receptive, surrender kind of awareness? And that's for me very important to enter into that. Then it's very relaxed. Then it's not me doing it so much. And so all the things like trust and faith, which are non-intellectual, those kinds of things are very important. And I think in a Western culture, we're intellectuals, and we're very good at analysis and figure things out and competent that way. But oftentimes the weak side of practice is the devotional side, the trusting side. And Buddhism doesn't give you sort of like a deity you trust in. What it gives us is like trust in your own goodness. But anyway, you know, and then I'm getting analytical again. So maybe as a suggestion, just to like bring that word up rather than controlling. Just what is trust? That's what I've been doing. Things like, what does it mean just to trust? Not saying you must trust now, Viradhamma, because that's just ego, isn't it? But it's, what is trust? And opening, that kind of stuff. To begin familiar, can awareness be a receptive, open kind of thing rather than a slow walking? Then I find there's a lot of beauty in that. It's reminding of what I don't know what you mean. Yes.
Could you speak a little bit about contemplation in respect of, we've just talked about a soft awareness as opposed to a more analytical awareness. And where does contemplation fit into that?
Could you pause? Contemplation, that's a good question. Oh, people don't understand that one. For me, so you have a teaching. So I've obviously taken the Buddhist teaching, so that's my vehicle of contemplation. And a teaching is not to be believed in, just in a sort of intellectual way. But it's to be considered in an existential way. In other words, I use the teaching to observe my existence as a human being. Now, a teaching is very, very good because it gives you, at least to say for me, the Buddhist teaching is very good because it gives me themes which are not just based upon my personal storyline, but are based on Dhamma. They kind of go deeper than me and my history. They go to the deep roots of consciousness, like things like thoughts, emotion, karma, these kinds of things. So then what happens in Buddhism is you read something like the cause of suffering is attachment to desire. And you just trot that one out, and okay, I'm right. But then you have to actually take that and say, well, what does he mean by attachment? And that's a difficult word, isn't it? And we have a lot of debates around that. What does he mean by desire? Does that mean wanting to be enlightened is desire? Huh? So then you get confused around that word. What is the abandonment of desire? Does that mean I can't have a cup of coffee? Yeah, so you're kind of challenged in that way. And if you are challenged and you think about it, that's good. If you just believe it, yeah. Attachment to desire is the cause of suffering. I shouldn't desire anything. That's stupid. That's not contemplation. That's just sort of hibernation kind of, you know, intellectual hibernation, isn't it? You're not really... So what you do is you want to apply the thinking mind in a contemplative way. So you have a theme like that, and then one reads again and again, and so you take a theme and you read it like Four Noble Truths, say, that kind of thing. You read it over and you read it over, but not in a way of just information gathering. You read it over and then that begins to manifest in your mind. You know, like if you've seen something on TV many, many times, or on radio, or on newspaper, that'll manifest in your mind as memory. So what you want to manifest in your mind as memory is themes of contemplation, themes of freedom. So whatever themes you take, then they come up into intellect. And then as one is saying, Buddhism is dealing with suffering and non-suffering, as I'm suffering, the teaching comes up. Is suffering because you're attached? What does that mean? And so I suffer through, what is attachment? And then the mind begins to observe in a silent way. You've got the information, you're looking now, and you're not just analyzing. You're looking, but you're looking through a lens, which is a theme, a perspective. And the Buddha's teaching is that these perspectives aren't arbitrary, they're liberating. You know, he said there are other perspectives in life, there's zoological perspectives and, you know, all kinds of perspectives, but this particular perspective liberates. So then, that's what you want going all the time. Some kind of theme of practice. Then intelligence is really... intelligence is combined with wisdom. That, you know, the investigative quality we have, all those really good qualities that we have in the Western culture, then it's used really, really well. And then, but the inside is like the aso. And you're kind of struggling with something. Ah. And then you start to think and give everyone a Dharma talk. So, that's a very, very important part of Buddhism. But it's not just meditation or belief. It's like really using these themes and deepening them into your mind. Any other thoughts? Okay. There's one at the back. Yes, please.
The owls,
yeah? What did I learn? I think I figured out the male and the female, and the territory competition, but I just figured they're most of them were teenagers. Tawny owls. We have a lot of bird life in that moisture. Anything else? Okay, we could stop. Yes?
I don't know how to formulate my question, but it's the resonance of the word being moral person, like, you know, we value the fact that we are a moral person, that's my question. And the opposite of that
is to not value being immoral, or what? Even unintentionally, or yeah, they do it, right, okay, right.
So how would you deal with that part?
Legal systems? Yeah, then social systems?
It could be legal or social, but it could be friends that also hurt, you know, when people that had the behavior that continued to be violent or hurtful.
Well, if a person can't reflect and can't work on themselves, you know, then you have to protect them from creating bad karma. So, you know, you have to protect them from doing things like that, but even though, you know, they might not like it. You know, so then you set up social structures or communication structures or to protect them and to protect society, for society at large. And I think in all those difficult areas you enter into, the more mindful you are, and the more you've really worked on letting go of fear and desire, and the heart's compassionate, you can be a lot of strength in that. Compassion, to be very, like Dalai Lama is a very strong man, but he's got a lovely softness to him, doesn't he? Tremendous compassion, but he's very, very courageous. That ability to be receptive, but then to also be able to be proactive, is the social realm. That's the social realm. It depends on the person. But we have to set boundaries. We have to say, no, that's wrong, we can't do that. To help those people and help our society. So like, I live in a monastic environment, and I have for many, so I live community life, which is has its interesting bits, but there is a common rule. And if someone is going against that rule, they're called for it. And if they can't live by the rule, fine, you're out of here. You know, it's not we're kind of mamsy-pamsy with people who are, you know, there was one guest who came, went down to the pub, got drunk, came back that night and said, fine, you're out of here. So, and we should come back in a year. So, you know, you can be really straight that way, which is important. So that's where like boundaries and rules and structures are very helpful. And I've been very fortunate that my I live in a kind of micro society, and so there things are very, very clearly defined, very helpful. Even then, there's a lot of gray areas, but that's very helpful. And if you have clear social structures, you can get beyond the personality issues. You know, we've got this agreement. This is how we live. But in lay life, it's not so easy because there are many more dimensions to the whole thing. Is that all right?
And then just a little, how would you talk to somebody that you know that you know exactly, and then how would you set a rule?
We have in place in our monastery ways of working with that, and one of the ways is we have regular group meetings, circles, sharing circles. And they're excellent forums for calling people on that. And because they're regular, and because we're quite reflective, and we're better at it now than we were before, we know how not to victimize someone. We know how to say, you know, this kind of behavior, you know, was very upsetting to me, and so on. And that's very powerful. But we have a reflective community. You know, everyone there is there for a particular reason, so there's an advantage. But what's in place? And also, we have a rule and we have a hierarchy. So what's in place is ways of admonishment. You know, we have ways of actually admonishing. We have a hierarchy that we pay obedience to. So there's a lot in place there that when difficulties arise, we can use those social tools. It's quite well developed now. If you don't have them in place, then it's a bit more difficult. And we had to develop a lot of things like that because we weren't so skillful at it.
I'd like to, on behalf of everyone, thank you for coming tonight. As usual, your teachings have been really helpful and clear, and I don't see myself anyway, so I'm going away thinking, I think I've really got it now. But I do hope the microphone works, just in case. But really, we appreciate, I know that you're on a self-retreat, and I really appreciate that you took the time for this. I know Amin has some announcements, and just to remind people that there's some tea and juice next door, in the room next door, and also some business ways to contact. Oh, and I want to also thank Marianne Carmen.